Side 2. Congo. Continuing on page 47. Did you pay any money?
No.
Was there a written contract?
No, I just called the zoo director.
Morton nodded.
Oral agreement, he said, writing.
And when the 3 years were up?
That was the spring of 1976. I asked the zoo for an extension of 6 years, and they gave it to me.
Again orally?
Yes, I called on the phone.
No correspondence?
No, they didn't seem very interested when I called. To tell you the truth, I think they had forgotten about Amy. The zoo has 4 gorillas anyway.
Morton frowned. Isn't a gorilla a pretty expensive animal? I mean, if you wanted to buy one for a pet or for the circus.
Gorillas are on the endangered list. You can't buy them as pets, but yes, they'd be pretty expensive.
How expensive?
Well, there's no established market value, but it would be $20,000 or $30,000.
And all during these years, you have been teaching her language?
Yes, Peter said. American Sign Language. She has a vocabulary of 620 words now.
Is that a lot?
More than any known primate.
Morton nodded, making notes.
You work with her every day in ongoing research?
Yes.
Good, Morton said. That's been very important in the animal custody cases so far.
For more than 100 years, there had been organized movements in Western countries to stop animal experimentation. They were led by the anti-vivisectionists, the RSPCA, the ASPCA. Originally, these organizations were a kind of lunatic fringe of animal lovers intent on stopping all animal research. Over the years, scientists had evolved a standard defense acceptable to the courts. Researchers claimed that their experiments had the goal of bettering the health and welfare of mankind, a higher priority than animal welfare. They pointed out that no one objected to animals being used as beasts of burden or for agricultural work, a life of drudgery to which animals had been subjected for thousands of years. Using animals in scientific experiments simply extended the idea that animals were the servants of human enterprises. In addition, animals were literally brutes. They had no self-awareness, no recognition of their existence in nature. This meant, in the words of philosopher George H. Mead, that animals have no rights. We are at liberty to cut off their lives. There is no wrong committed when an animal's life is taken away. He has not lost anything. Many people were troubled by these views. But attempts to establish guidelines quickly ran into logical problems. The most obvious concerned the perceptions of animals further down the phylogenetic scale. Few researchers operated on dogs, cats, and other mammals without anesthesia. But what about annelid worms, crayfish, leeches, and squid? Ignoring these creatures was a form of taxonomic discrimination. Yet if these animals deserved consideration, shouldn't it also be illegal to throw a live lobster into a pot of boiling water? The question of what constituted cruelty to animals was confused by the animal societies themselves. In some countries, they fought the extermination of rats, and in 1968 there was the bizarre Australian pharmaceutical case. Footnote: A new pharmaceutical factory was built in Western Australia. In this factory, all the pills came out on a conveyor belt. A person had to watch the belt and press buttons to sort the pills into separate bins by size and color. A Skinnerian animal behaviorist pointed out that it would be simple to teach pigeons to watch the pills and peck colored keys to do the sorting process. Incredulous factory managers agreed to a test. The pigeons indeed performed reliably and were duly placed on the assembly line. Then the RSPCA stepped in and put a stop to it on the grounds that it represented cruelty to animals. The job was turned over to a human operator, for whom it did not apparently represent cruelty.
Text continues.
In the face of these ironies, the courts hesitated to interfere with animal experimentation. As a practical matter, researchers were free to do as they wished. The volume of animal research was extraordinary. During the 1970s, 64 million animals were killed in experiments in the United States each year. But attitudes had slowly changed. Language studies with dolphins and apes made it clear that these animals were not only intelligent, but self-aware. They recognized themselves in mirrors and photographs. In 1974, scientists themselves formed the International Primate Protection League to monitor research involving monkeys and apes. In March 1978, the Indian government banned the export of rhesus monkeys to research laboratories around the world. And there were court cases which concluded that in some instances, animals did indeed have rights. The old view was analogous to slavery. The animal was the property of its owner, who could do whatever he wished. But now, ownership became secondary. In February 1977, there was a case involving a dolphin named Mary, released by a lab technician into the open ocean. The University of Hawaii prosecuted the technician, charging loss of a valuable research animal. Two trials resulted in hung juries. The case was dropped. In November 1978, there was a custody case involving a chimpanzee named Arthur, who was fluent in sign language. His owner, Johns Hopkins University, decided to sell him and close the program. His trainer, William Levine, went to court and obtained custody on the grounds that Arthur knew language and thus was no longer a chimpanzee. One of the pertinent facts, Morton said, was that when Arthur was confronted by other chimpanzees, he referred to them as black things. And when Arthur was twice asked to sort photographs of people and photographs of chimps, he sorted them correctly, except that both times he put his own picture in the stack with the people. He obviously did not consider himself a chimpanzee, and the court ruled that he should remain with his trainer, since any separation would cause him severe psychic distress. "Amy cries when I leave her," Elliot said. "When you conduct experiments, do you obtain her permission?" "Always," Elliot smiled. Morton obviously had no sense of day-to-day life with Amy. It was essential to obtain her permission for any course of action, even a ride in a car. She was a powerful animal, and she could be willful and stubborn. "Do you keep a record of her acquiescence?" "Videotapes." "Does she understand the experiments you propose?" He shrugged. "She says she does." "You follow a system of rewards and punishments?" "All animal behaviorists do." Morton frowned. "What forms do her punishments take?" "Well, when she's a bad girl, I make her stand in the corner facing the wall, or else I send her to bed early without her peanut butter and jelly snack." "What about torture and shock treatments?" "Ridiculous." "You never physically punish the animal?" "She's a pretty damn big animal. Usually I worry that she'll get mad and punish me." Morton smiled and stood. "You're going to be all right," he said. "Any court will rule that Amy is your ward and that you must decide any ultimate disposition in her case." He hesitated. "I know this sounds strange, but could you put Amy on the stand?" "I guess so," Elliot said. "Do you think it will come to that?" "Not in this case," Morton said, "but sooner or later it will. You watch. Within 10 years, there will be a custody case involving a language-using primate, and the ape will be in the witness box." Elliot shook his hand and said as he was leaving, "By the way, would I have any problem taking her out of the country?" "If there is a custody case, you could have trouble taking her across state lines," Morton said. "Are you planning to take her out of the country?" "Yes." "Then my advice is to do it fast and don't tell anyone," Morton said. Elliot entered his office on the third floor of the zoology department building shortly after 9. His secretary, Carolyn, said, Dr. Ross called from that wildlife fund in Houston. She's on her way to San Francisco. Mr. Hakamichi called 3 times, says it's important. The Project Amy staff meeting is set for 10 o'clock, and Wendy is in your office." "Really?" James Weldon was a senior professor in the department, a weak, blustery man. Windy Weldon was usually portrayed in departmental cartoons as holding a wet finger in the air. He was a master at knowing which way the wind was blowing. For the past several days, he had avoided Peter Elliot and his staff. Elliot went into his office. "Well, Peter, my boy," Weldon said, reaching out to give his version of a hearty handshake, "you're in early." Elliot was instantly wary. "I thought I'd beat the crowds," he said. The picketers did not show up until 10 o'clock, sometimes later, depending on when they had arranged to meet the TV news crews. That was how it worked these days, protest by appointment. "They're not coming anymore," Weldon smiled. He handed Elliot the late city edition of the Chronicle, a front-page story circled in black pen. Eleanor Vries had resigned her position as regional director of the PPA, pleading overwork and personal pressures. A statement from the PPA in New York indicated that they had seriously misconstrued the nature and content of Elliot's research. "Meaning what?" Elliot asked. "Belli's office reviewed your paper and Vries' public statements about torture and decided that the PPA was exposed to a major libel suit," Weldon said. "The New York office is terrified. They'll be making overtures to you later today. Personally, I hope you'll be understanding." Elliot dropped into his chair. "What about the faculty meeting next week?" "Oh, that's essential," Weldon said. "There's no question that the faculty will want to discuss unethical conduct on the part of the media and issue a strong statement in your support. I'm drawing up a statement now to come from my office." The irony of this was not lost on Elliot. "You sure you want to go out on a limb?" he asked. "I'm behind you 1,000%. I hope you know that," Weldon said. Weldon was restless, pacing around the office, staring at the walls, which were covered with Amy's finger paintings. Windy had something further on his mind. "She's still making these same pictures?" he asked finally. "Yes," Elliot said. "And you still have no idea what they mean?" Elliot paused. At best, it was premature to tell Weldon what they thought the pictures meant. "No idea," he said. "Are you sure?" Weldon asked, frowning. "I think somebody knows what they mean." "Why is that?" "Something very strange has happened," Weldon said. "Someone has offered to buy Amy." "To buy her? What are you talking about, to buy her?" "A lawyer in Los Angeles called my office yesterday and offered to buy her for $150,000. "It must be some rich do-gooder," Elliot said, "trying to save Amy from torture." "I don't think so," Weldon said. "For one thing, the offer came from Japan. Someone named Hakamichi. He's in electronics in Tokyo. I found that out when the lawyer called back this morning to increase his offer to $250,000.
$250,000? Elliot said. "For Amy?" Of course, it was out of the question. He would never sell her, but why would anyone offer so much money? Weldon had an answer.
"This kind of money, $250,000, can only be coming from private enterprise, industry. Clearly, Hakamichi has read about your work and found a use for speaking primates in an industrial context."
Windy stared at the ceiling, a sure sign he was about to wax eloquent.
"I think a new field might be opening up here. The training of primates for industrial applications in the real world."
Peter Elliott swore. He was not teaching Amy language in order to put a hard hat on her head and a lunch pail in her hand, and he said so.
"You're not thinking it through," Weldon said. "What if we are on the verge of a new field of applied behavior for the great apes? Think what it means. Not only funding to the department, and an opportunity for applied research. Most important, there would be a reason to keep these animals alive. You know that the great apes are becoming extinct. The chimps in Africa are greatly reduced in number. The orangs of Borneo are losing their natural habitat to the timber cutters and will be extinct in 10 years. The gorilla is down to 3,000 in the Central African forests. These animals will all disappear in our lifetime unless there is a reason to keep them alive as species. You may provide that reason, Peter, my boy. Think about it."
Elliot did think about it, and he discussed it at the Project Amy staff meeting at 10 o'clock. They considered possible industrial applications for apes and possible advantages to employers, such as the lack of unions and fringe benefits. In the late 20th century, these were major considerations. In 1978, for each new automobile that rolled off the Detroit assembly lines, the cost of worker health benefits exceeded the cost of all the steel used to build the car. But they concluded the division of industrialized apes was wildly fanciful. An ape like Amy was not a cheap and stupid version of a human worker, quite the opposite. Amy was a highly intelligent and complex creature, out of her element in the modern industrial world. She demanded a great deal of supervision. She was whimsical and unreliable, and her health was always at risk. It simply didn't make sense to use her in industry. If Hakamichi had visions of apes wielding soldering irons on a microelectronic assembly line, building TVs and hi-fi sets, he was sorely misinformed. The only note of caution came from Bergman, the child psychologist. "A quarter of a million is a lot of money," he said. "And Mr. Hakamichi is probably no fool. He must have learned about Amy through her drawings, which implies she is neurotic and difficult. If he's interested in her, I'd bet it's because of her drawings. But I can't imagine why those drawings should be worth $250,000. Neither could anyone else. And the discussion turned to the drawings themselves and the newly translated texts. Sarah Johnson, in charge of research, started out with the flat comment, "I have bad news about the Congo." Footnote. Johnson's principal reference was the definitive work by A.J. Parkinson, The Congo Delta in Myth and History, London, Peters, 1904. Text continues. "For most of recorded history," she explained, "nothing was known about the Congo. The ancient Egyptians on the Upper Nile knew only that their river originated far to the south, in a region they called the Land of Trees. This was a mysterious place, with forests so dense they were as dark as night in the middle of the day. Strange creatures inhabited this perpetual gloom, including little men with tails, and animals half black and half white. For nearly 4,000 years afterward, nothing more substantial was learned about the interior of Africa. The Arabs came to East Africa in the 7th century AD in search of gold, ivory, spices, and slaves, but the Arabs were merchant seamen and did not venture inland. They called the interior Zinj, the land of the blacks, a region of fable and fantasy. There were stories of vast forests and tiny men with tails, stories of mountains that spewed fire and turned the sky black, stories of native villages overwhelmed by monkeys, which would have congress with the women, stories of great giants with hairy bodies and flat noses, stories of creatures half leopard, half man, stories of native markets where the fattened carcasses of men were butchered and sold as a delicacy. Such stories were sufficiently forbidding to keep the Arabs on the coast, despite other stories equally alluring. Mountains of shimmering gold, riverbeds gleaming with diamonds, animals that spoke the language of men, great jungle civilizations of unimaginable splendor. In particular, one story was repeated again and again in early accounts. The story of the lost city of Zinj. According to legend, a city known to the Hebrews of Solomonic times had been a source of inconceivable wealth in diamonds. The caravan route to the city had been jealously guarded, passed from father to son, as a sacred trust for generation after generation. But the diamond mines were exhausted, and the city itself now lay in crumbling ruins, somewhere in the dark heart of Africa. The arduous caravan routes were long since swallowed up by jungle, and the last trader who remembered the way had carried his secret with him to the grave many hundreds of years before. This mysterious and alluring place the Arabs called the Lost City of Zinj. Footnote. The fabled city of Zinj formed the basis for H. Rider Haggard's popular novel, King Solomon's Mines, first published in 1885. Haggard, a gifted linguist, had served on the staff of the governor of Natal in 1875, and he presumably heard of Zinj from the neighboring Zulus at that time. Text continues. Yet despite its enduring fame, Johnson could find few detailed descriptions of the city. In 1187, Ibn Baratu, an Arab in Mombasa, recorded that the natives of the region tell of a lost city far inland called Zinj. There, the inhabitants, who are black, once lived in wealth and luxury, and even the slaves decorated themselves with jewels, and especially blue diamonds, for a great store of diamonds is there. In 1292, a Persian named Mohammed Zaid stated that a large diamond, the size of a man's clenched fist, was exhibited on the streets of Zanzibar, and all said it had come from the interior, where the ruins of a city called Zinj may be found. And it is here that such diamonds may be found in profusion, scattered upon the ground and also in rivers.
In 1334, another Arab, Ibn Muhammad, stated that our number made arrangements to seek out the city of Zinj, but quitted our quest upon learning that the city was long since abandoned and much ruined. It is said that the aspect of the city is wondrous strange, for doors and windows are built in the curve of a half moon, and the residences are now overtaken by a violent race of hairy men who speak in whispers no known language. Then the Portuguese, those indefatigable explorers, arrived. By 1544, they were venturing inland from the west coast up the mighty Congo River. But they soon encountered all the obstacles that would prevent exploration of Central Africa for hundreds of years to come. The Congo was not navigable beyond the first set of rapids, 200 miles inland, at what was once Leopoldville and is now Kinshasa. The natives were hostile and cannibalistic, and the hot, steaming jungle was the source of disease, malaria, sleeping sickness, bilharzia, blackwater fever, which decimated foreign intruders. The Portuguese never managed to penetrate the central Congo. Neither did the English under Captain Brenner in 1644. His entire party was lost. The Congo would remain for 200 years as a blank spot on the civilized maps of the world. But the early explorers repeated the legends of the interior, including the story of Zinj. A Portuguese artist, Juan Diego de Valdez, drew a widely acclaimed picture of the lost city of Zinj in 1642. But, Sarah Johnson said, he also drew pictures of men with tails and monkeys having carnal knowledge of native women. Somebody groaned. Apparently Valdez was crippled, she continued. He lived all his life in the town of Setúbal, drinking with sailors and drawing pictures based on his conversations. Africa was not thoroughly explored until the mid-19th century by Burton and Speke, Baker and Livingston, and especially Stanley. No trace of the lost city of Zinj was found by any of them, nor had any trace of the apocryphal city been found in the 100 years since. The gloom that descended over the Project Amy staff meeting was profound. I told you it was bad news, Sarah Johnson said. You mean, Peter Elliott said, that this picture is based on a description, and we don't know whether the city actually exists or not. I'm afraid so, Sarah Johnson said. There is no proof that the city in the picture exists at all. It's just a story. 4. Resolution. Peter Elliott's unquestioned reliance on 20th century hard data, facts, figures, graphs, left him unprepared for the possibility that the 1642 engraving, in all its detail, was merely the fanciful speculation of an uninhibited artist. The news came as a shock. Their plans to take Amy to the Congo suddenly appeared childishly naive. The resemblance of her sketches, schematic drawings to the 1642 Valdez engraving was obviously coincidental. How could they ever have imagined that a lost city of Zinj was anything but the stuff of ancient fable? In the 17th century world of widening horizons and new wonders, the idea of such a city would have seemed perfectly reasonable, even compelling. But in the computerized 20th century, the lost city of Zinj was as unlikely as Camelot or Xanadu. They had been fools ever to take it seriously. The lost city doesn't exist, he said. Oh, it exists, all right, she said. There's no doubt about that. Elliot glanced up quickly, and then he saw that Sarah Johnson had not answered him. A tall, gangly girl in her early 20s stood at the back of the room. She might have been considered beautiful, except for her cold, aloof demeanor. This girl was dressed in a severe business-like suit, and she carried a briefcase, which she now set on the table, popping the latches. "I'm Dr. Ross," she announced, "from the Wildlife Fund, and I'd like your opinion of these pictures." She passed around a series of photographs, which were viewed by the staff with an assortment of whistles and sighs. At the head of the table, Elliot waited impatiently until the photographs came down to him.
They were grainy, black-and-white images with horizontal scanning line streaks, photographed off a video screen. But the image was unmistakable. A ruined city in the jungle, with curious, inverted, crescent-shaped doors and windows. 5. Amy.
By satellite? Elliot repeated, hearing the tension in his voice.
That's right. The pictures were transmitted by satellite from Africa 2 days ago.
Then you know the location of this ruin?
Of course.
And your expedition leaves in a matter of hours?
6 hours and 23 minutes, to be exact, Ross said, glancing at her digital watch. Elliot adjourned the meeting and talked privately with Ross for more than an hour. Elliot later claimed that Ross had deceived him about the purpose of the expedition and the hazards they would face, but Elliot was eager to go, and probably not inclined to be too fussy about the reasons behind Ross's coming expedition or the dangers involved. As a skilled grantsman, he had long ago grown comfortable with situations where other people's money and his own motivations did not exactly coincide. This was the cynical side of academic life. How much pure research had been funded because it might cure cancer? A researcher promised anything to get his money. Apparently, it never occurred to Elliot that Ross might be using him as coldly as he was using her. From the start, Ross was never entirely truthful. She had been instructed by Travis to explain the Ertz-Congo mission with a little data dropout. Data dropout was second nature to her. Everyone at Ertz had learned to say no more than was necessary. Elliot treated her as if she were an ordinary funding agency, and that was a serious mistake. In the final analysis, Ross and Elliot misjudged each other, for each presented a deceptive appearance, and in the same way. Elliot appeared so shy and retiring that one Berkeley faculty member had commented, "It's no wonder he's devoted his life to apes. He can't work up the nerve to talk to people." But Elliot had been a tough middle linebacker in college, and his diffident academic demeanor concealed a head-crunching, ambitious drive. Similarly, Karen Ross, despite her youthful cheerleader beauty and soft, seductive Texas accent, possessed great intelligence and a deep inner toughness. She had matured early, and a high school teacher had once appraised her as the very flower of virile Texas womanhood. Ross felt responsible for the previous Ertz expedition, and she was determined to rectify past errors. It was at least possible that Elliot and Amy could help her when she got on site. That was reason enough to take them with her. Beyond that, Ross was concerned about the consortium, which was obviously seeking Elliot, since Hakamichi was calling. If she took Elliot and Amy with her, she removed a possible advantage to the consortium. Again, reason enough to take them with her. Finally, she needed a cover in case her expedition was stopped at one of the borders, and a primatologist and an ape provided a perfect cover. But in the end, Karen Ross wanted only the Congo diamonds, and she was prepared to say anything, do anything, sacrifice anything to get them. In photographs taken at San Francisco Airport, Elliot and Ross appear as two smiling, youthful academics embarking on a lark of an expedition to Africa. But in fact, their motivations were different and grimly held. Elliot was reluctant to tell her how theoretical and academic his goals were, and Ross was reluctant to admit how pragmatic were hers. In any case, by midday on June 14th, Karen Ross found herself riding with Peter Elliot in his battered Fiat sedan along Hallowell Road, going past the university athletic field. She had some misgivings. They were going to meet Amy. Elliot unlocked the door with its red sign, "Do not disturb animal experimentation in progress." Behind the door, Amy was grunting and scratching impatiently. Elliot paused. "When you meet her," he said, "remember that she is a gorilla and not a human being. Gorillas have their own etiquette. Don't speak loudly or make any sudden movements until she gets used to you. If you smile, don't show your teeth because bared teeth are a threat. And keep your eyes downcast because direct stares from strangers are considered hostile. Don't stand too close to me or touch me because she's very jealous. If you talk to her, don't lie. Even though she uses sign language, she understands most human speech and we usually just talk to her. She can tell when you're lying and she doesn't like it." She doesn't like it? She dismisses you, won't talk to you, and gets bitchy. Anything else? No, it should be okay. He smiled reassuringly. We have this traditional greeting, even though she's getting a little big for it. He opened the door, braced himself, and said, "Good morning, Amy." A huge black shape came leaping out through the open door into his arms. Elliot staggered back under the impact. Ross was astonished by the size of the animal. She had been imagining something smaller and cuter. Amy was as large as an adult human female. Amy kissed Elliot on the cheek with her large lips, her black head seeming enormous alongside his. Her breath steamed his glasses. Ross smelled a sweetish odor and watched as he gently unwrapped her long arms from around his shoulders. "Amy happy this morning?" he asked. Amy's fingers moved quickly near her cheek as if she were brushing away flies. "Yes, I was late today," Elliot said. She moved her fingers again, and Ross realized that Amy was signing. The speed was surprising. She had expected something much slower and more deliberate. She noticed that Amy's eyes never left Elliot's face. She was extraordinarily attentive, focusing on him with total animal watchfulness. She seemed to absorb everything, his posture, his expression, his tone of voice, as well as his words. "I had to work," Elliot said. She sighed again quickly, like human gestures of dismissal. "Yes, that's right. People work." He led Amy back into the trailer and motioned for Karen Ross to follow. Inside the trailer, he said, "Amy, this is Dr. Ross. Say hello to Dr. Ross." Amy looked at Karen Ross suspiciously. "Hello, Amy," Karen Ross said, smiling at the floor. She felt a little foolish behaving this way, but Amy was large enough to frighten her. Amy stared at Karen Ross for a moment, then walked away across the trailer to her easel. She had been finger-painting and now resumed this activity, ignoring them. "What's that mean?" Ross said. She distinctly felt she was being snubbed. "We'll see," Elliot said. After a few moments, Amy ambled back, walking on her knuckles. She went directly to Karen Ross, sniffed her crotch, and examined her minutely. She seemed particularly interested in Ross's leather purse, which had a shiny brass clasp. Ross said later that it was just like any cocktail party in Houston. I was being checked out by another woman. I had the feeling that any minute she was going to ask me where I bought my clothes. That was not the outcome, however. Amy reached up and deliberately streaked globs of green finger paint on Ross's skirt. "I don't think this is going too well," Karen Ross said. Elliot had watched the progress of this first meeting with more apprehension than he was willing to admit. Introducing new humans to Amy was often difficult, particularly if they were women. Over the years, Elliot had come to recognize many distinctly feminine traits in Amy. She could be coy, she responded to flattery, she was preoccupied with her appearance, loved makeup, and was very fussy about the color of the sweaters she wore in the winter. She preferred men to women, and she was openly jealous of Elliot's girlfriends. He rarely brought them around to meet her, but sometimes in the morning she would sniff him for perfume, and she always commented if he had not changed his clothing overnight. The situation might have been amusing if not for the fact that Amy made occasional unprovoked attacks on strange women, and an attack by Amy was never amusing. Amy returned to the easel and signed, "No like woman, no like Amy, no like go away, away." "Come on, Amy, be a good gorilla," Peter said. "What did she say?" Ross asked, going to the sink to wash the finger paint from her dress. Peter noticed that she did not squeal and shriek as many visitors did when they received an unfriendly greeting from Amy. "She said she likes your dress," he said. Amy shot him a look, as she always did whenever Elliot mistranslated her. "Amy not lie. Peter not lie." "Be nice, Amy," he said. "Karen is a nice human person." Amy grunted and returned to her work, painting rapidly. "What happens now?" Karen Ross said. "Give her time," he smiled reassuringly. "She needs time to adjust." He did not bother to explain that it was much worse with chimpanzees. Chimps threw feces at strangers and even at workers they knew well. They sometimes attacked to establish dominance. Chimpanzees had a strong need to determine who was in charge. Fortunately, guerrillas were much less formal in their dominance hierarchies and less violent. At that moment, Amy ripped the paper from the easel and shredded it noisily, flinging the pieces around the room.
"Is this part of the adjustment?" Karen Ross asked. She seemed more amused than frightened.
"Amy, cut it out," Peter said, allowing his tone to convey irritation. "Amy!" Amy sat in the middle of the floor, surrounded by the paper. She tore it angrily and signed, "This woman, this woman." It was classic displacement behavior. Whenever guerrillas did not feel comfortable with direct aggression, they did something symbolic. In symbolic terms, she was now tearing Karen Ross apart. And she was getting worked up, beginning with the Project Amy staff called sequencing. Just as human beings first became red-faced and then tensed their bodies, and then shouted and threw things before they finally resorted to direct physical aggression, so gorillas passed through a stereotyped behavioral sequence on the way to physical aggression. Tearing up paper or grass would be followed by lateral crab-like movements and grunts. Then she would slap the ground, making as much noise as possible, and then Amy would charge if he didn't interrupt the sequence. "Amy," he said sternly, "Karen, button woman." Amy stopped shredding. In her world, button was the acknowledged term for a person of high status. Amy was extremely sensitive to individual moods and behavior, and she had no difficulty observing the staff and deciding who was superior to whom. But among strangers, Amy, as a gorilla, was utterly impervious to formal human status cues. The principal indicators, clothing, bearing, and speech, had no meaning to her. As a young animal, she had inexplicably attacked policemen. After several biting episodes and threatened lawsuits, they finally learned that Amy found police uniforms with their shiny buttons clown-like and ridiculous. She assumed that anyone so foolishly dressed must be of inferior status and safe to attack. After they had taught her the concept of button, she treated anyone in uniform with deference. Amy now stared at Button Ross with new respect. Surrounded by the torn paper, she seemed suddenly embarrassed, as if she had made a social error. Without being told, she went and stood in the corner facing the wall.
"What's that about?" Ross said.
"She knows she's been bad."
"You make her stand in the corner like a child? She didn't mean any harm."
Before Elliot could warn against it, she went over to Amy. Amy stared steadfastly at the corner. Ross unshouldered her purse and set it on the floor within Amy's reach. Nothing happened for a moment. Then Amy took the purse, looked at Karen, then looked at Peter. Peter said, "She'll wreck whatever's inside."
"That's all right."
Amy immediately opened the brass clasp and dumped the contents on the floor. She began sifting through, signing, "Lipstick, lipstick, Amy like, Amy want lipstick, want."
"She wants lipstick."
Ross bent over and found it for her. Amy removed the cap and smeared a red circle on Karen's face. She then smiled and grunted happily and crossed the room to her mirror, which was mounted on the floor. She applied lipstick.
"I think we're doing better," Karen Ross said.
Across the room, Amy squatted by the mirror, happily making a mess of her face. She grinned at her smart image, then applied lipstick to her teeth. It seemed a good time to ask her the question. "Amy want take trip?" Peter said. Amy loved trips and regarded them as special treats. After an especially good day, Elliot often took her for a ride to a nearby drive-in, where she would have an orange drink, sucking it through the straw and enjoying the commotion she caused among the other people there. Lipstick and an offer of a trip was almost too much pleasure for one morning. She signed, "Car trip?" "No, not in the car. A long trip. Many days."
"Leave house?"
"Yes, leave house. Many days." This made her suspicious. The only times she had left the house for many days had been during hospitalizations for pneumonia and urinary tract infections. They had not been pleasant trips. She signed, "Where go trip?"
"To the jungle, Amy."
There was a long pause. At first, he thought she had not understood, but she knew the word for jungle, and she should be able to put it all together. Amy signed thoughtfully to herself, repetitively, as she always did when she was mulling things over. "Jungle trip, trip, jungle, go, trip, jungle, go." She set aside her lipstick. She stared at the bits of paper on the floor, and then she began to pick them up and put them in the wastebasket.
What does that mean? Karen Ross asked.
That means Amy wants to take a trip, Peter Elliott said.
6. Departure. The hinged nose of the Boeing 747 cargo jet lay open like a jaw, exposing the cavernous, brightly lit interior. The plane had been flown up from Houston to San Francisco that afternoon. It was now 9 o'clock at night, and puzzled workers were loading on the large aluminum travel cage, boxes of vitamin pills, a portable potty, and cartons of toys. One workman pulled out a Mickey Mouse drinking cup and stared at it, shaking his head. Outside on the concrete, Elliot stood with Amy, who covered her ears against the whine of the jet engines. She signed to Peter, "Bird's noisy." "We fly bird, Amy," he said. Amy had never flown before and had never seen an airplane at close hand. "We go car," she decided, looking at the plane.
"We can't go by car. We fly."
"Fly where fly?" Amy signed.
"Fly jungle."
This seemed to perplex her, but he did not want to explain further. Like all gorillas, Amy had an aversion to water, refusing to cross even small streams. He knew she would be distressed to hear that they would be flying over large bodies of water. Changing the subject, he suggested they board the plane and look around. As they climbed the sloping ramp up the nose, Amy signed, "Where Button Woman?" He had not seen Ross for the last 5 hours and was surprised to discover that she was already on board, talking on a telephone mounted on a wall of the cargo hold, one hand cupped over her free ear to block the noise. Elliot overheard her say, "Well, Irving seems to think it's enough. Yes, we have 4 907 units, and we are prepared to match and absorb. 2 micro HUDs, that's all."
"Yes, why not?"
She finished the call, turned to Elliot and Amy.
"Everything okay?" he asked.
"Fine. I'll show you around." She led him deeper into the cargo hold with Amy at his side. Elliot glanced back and saw the chauffeur coming up the ramp with a series of numbered metal boxes marked Intech Incorporated, followed by serial numbers. "This," Karen Ross said, "is the main cargo hold." It was filled with four-wheel drive trucks, land cruisers, amphibious vehicles, inflatable boats, and racks of clothing, equipment, food, all tagged with computer codes, all loaded in modules. Ross explained that Ertz could outfit expeditions to any geographical and climatic condition in a matter of hours. She kept emphasizing the speed possible with computer assembly.
"Why the rush?" Elliot asked.
"It's business," Karen Ross said. 4 years ago, there were no companies like Ertz. Now there are 9 around the world, and what they all sell is competitive advantage, meaning speed. Back in the 60s, a company, say an oil company, might spend months or years investigating a possible site. But that's no longer competitive. Business decisions are made in weeks or days. The pace of everything has speeded up. We're already looking to the 1980s, where we'll provide answers in hours. Right now, the average Ertz contract runs a little under 3 weeks or 500 hours. But by 1990, there will be close of business data. An executive can call us in the morning for information anywhere in the world and have a complete report transmitted by computer to his desk before close of business that evening, say 10 to 12 hours. As they continued the tour, Elliot noticed that although the trucks and vehicles caught the eye first, much of the aircraft's storage space was given over to aluminum modules marked C3I.
"That's right," Ross said. "Command, control, communications, and intelligence. They're Micronic components, the most expensive budget item we carry. When we started outfitting expeditions, 12% of the cost went to electronics. Now it's up to 31% and climbing every gear. It's field communications, remote sensing, defense, and so on."
She led them to the rear of the plane, where there was a modular living area, nicely furnished, with a large computer console and bunks for sleeping. Amy signed, "Nice house."
"Yes, it is nice."
They were introduced to Jensen, a young bearded geologist, and to Irving Levine, who announced that he was the Triple E. The two men were running some kind of probability study on the computer, but they paused to shake hands with Amy, who regarded them gravely, and then turned her attention to the screen. Amy was captivated by the colorful screen images and bright LEDs, and kept trying to punch the buttons herself. She signed, "Amy Play Box."
Not now, Amy,
Elliot said, and swatted her hands away. Jensen asked, Is she always this way?
I'm afraid so, Elliot said. She likes computers. She's worked around them ever since she was very young, and she thinks of them as her private property.
And then he added, What's a triple E?
Expedition Electronics Expert, Irving said cheerfully. He was a short man with an impish, quick smile. Doing the best I can.
We picked up some stuff from Intech, that's about all. God knows what the Japs and the Germans will throw at us.
Oh, damn, there she goes, Jensen said, laughing as Amy pushed the buttons. Elliot said, Amy, no.
It's just a game, probably not interesting to apes, Jensen said, and he added, She can't hurt anything.
Amy signed, Amy, good gorilla,
and pushed the buttons on the computer again. She appeared relaxed, and Elliot was grateful for the distraction the computer provided. He was always amused by the sight of Amy's heavy, dark form before a computer console. She would touch her lower lip thoughtfully before pushing the buttons in what seemed a parody of human behavior. Ross, practical as always, brought them back to mundane matters.
Will Amy sleep on one of the bunks?
Elliot shook his head.
No, gorillas expect to make a fresh bed each night.
Give her some blankets, and she'll twist them into a nest on the floor and sleep there. Ross nodded.
What about her vitamins and medications? Will she swallow pills?
Ordinarily, you have to bribe her or hide the pills in a piece of banana. She tends to gulp banana without chewing it.
Without chewing?
Ross nodded as if that were important.
We have a standard issue, she said. I'll see that she gets them.
She takes the same vitamins that people do, except that she'll need lots of ascorbic acid.
We issue 3,000 units a day. That's enough?
Good.
And she'll tolerate anti-malarials?
We have to start them right away.
Generally speaking, Elliot said, she has the same reaction to medication as people.
Ross nodded.
Will the cabin pressurization bother her?
It's set at 5,000 feet.
Elliot shook his head. She's a mountain gorilla, and they live at 5,000 to 9,000 feet, so she's actually altitude-adapted. But she's acclimated to a moist climate, and she dehydrates quickly. We'll have to keep forcing fluids on her.
Can she use the head?
The seat's probably too high for her, Elliot said, but I brought her potty.
She'll use her potty?
Sure.
I have a new collar for her. Will she wear it?
If you give it to her as a gift.
As they reviewed other details of Amy's requirements, Elliot realized that something had happened during the last few hours, almost without his knowing it. Amy's unpredictable, dream-driven, neurotic behavior had fallen away. It was as if the earlier behavior was irrelevant. Now that she was going on a trip, she was no longer moody and introspective. Her interests were outgoing. She was once again a youthful female gorilla. He found himself wondering whether her dreams, her depression, finger paintings, everything, were a result of her confined laboratory environment for so many years. At first, the laboratory had been agreeable, like a crib for young children. But perhaps in later years it pinched. Perhaps, he thought, Amy just needed a little excitement. Excitement was in the air. As he talked with Ross, Elliot felt something remarkable was about to happen. This expedition with Amy was the first example of an event primate researchers had predicted for years, the Pearl thesis. Frederick Pearl was a theoretical animal behaviorist. At a meeting of the American Ethnological Society in New York in 1972, he had said, Now that primates have learned sign language, it is only a matter of time until someone takes an animal into the field to assist the study of wild animals of the same species. We can imagine language-skilled primates acting as interpreters or perhaps even as ambassadors for mankind in contact with wild creatures. Pearl's thesis attracted considerable attention and funding from the U.S. Air Force, which had supported linguistic research since the 1960s. According to one story, the Air Force had a secret project called Contour, involving possible contact with alien life forms. The official military position was that UFOs were of natural origin. But the military was covering its bets. Should alien contact occur, linguistic fundamentals were obviously critically important. And taking primates into the field was seen as an example of contact with alien intelligence. Hence, the Air Force funding. Pearl predicted that fieldwork would be undertaken before 1976, but in fact, no one had yet done it. The reason was that on closer examination, no one could figure out quite what the advantages were. Most language-using primates were as baffled by wild primates as human beings were. Some, like the chimpanzee Arthur, denied any association with their own kind, referring to them as black things. Amy, who had been taken to the zoo to view other gorillas, recognized them, but was haughty, calling them stupid gorillas, once she found that when she signed to them, they did not reply. Such observations led another researcher, John Bates, to say in 1977 that we are producing an educated animal elite which demonstrates the same snobbish aloofness that a Ph.D. shows toward a truck driver. It is highly unlikely that the generation of language-using primates will be skillful ambassadors in the field. They are simply too disdainful. But the truth was that no one really knew what would happen when a primate was taken into the field, because no one had done it. Amy would be the first. At 11 o'clock, the Earth's cargo plane taxied down the runway at San Francisco International, lifted ponderously into the air, and headed east through the darkness toward Africa. Day 3, Tangier, June 15, 1979. 1. Ground Truth. Peter Elliott had known Amy since infancy. He prided himself on his ability to predict her responses, although he had only known her in a laboratory setting. Now, as she was faced with new situations, her behavior surprised him. Elliot had anticipated Amy would be terrified at the takeoff, and had prepared a syringe with Thorolin tranquilizer. But sedation proved unnecessary. Amy watched Jensen and Levine buckle their seatbelts, and she immediately buckled herself in, too. She seemed to regard the procedure as an amusing, if simple-minded, game. And although her eyes widened when she heard the full roar of the engines, the human beings around her did not seem disturbed, and Amy imitated their bored indifference, raising her eyebrows and sighing at the tedium of it all. Once airborne, however, Amy looked out the window and immediately panicked. She released her seatbelt and scurried back and forth across the passenger compartment, moving from window to window, knocking people aside in whimpering terror while she signed, "Where ground, ground, where ground?" Outside, the ground was black and indistinct. "Where ground?" Elliot shot her with Thorolin and then began grooming her, sitting her down and plucking at her hair. In the wild, primates devoted several hours each day to grooming one another, removing ticks and lice. Grooming behavior was important in ordering the group's social dominance structure. There was a pattern by which animals groomed each other, and with what frequency. And, like back rubs for people, grooming seemed to have a soothing, calming effect. Within minutes, Amy had relaxed enough to notice that the others were drinking, and she promptly demanded a green drop drink, her term for a martini with an olive, and a cigarette. She was allowed this on special occasions, such as departmental parties, and Elliot now gave her a drink and a cigarette. But the excitement proved too much for her. An hour later, she was quietly looking out the window and signing "nice picture" to herself. When she vomited, she apologized abjectly. "Amy sorry, Amy mess, Amy, Amy sorry." "It's all right, Amy," Elliot assured her, stroking the back of her head. Soon afterward, signing "Amy sleep now," she twisted the blankets into a nest on the floor and went to sleep, snoring loudly through her broad nostrils. Lying next to her, Elliot thought, "How do other gorillas get to sleep with this racket?" Elliot had his own reaction to the journey. When he had first met Karen Ross, he assumed she was an academic like himself. But this enormous airplane, filled with computerized equipment, the acronymic complexity of the entire operation, suggested that Earth Resources Technology had powerful resources behind it, perhaps even a military association. Karen Ross laughed. "We're much too organized to be military." She then told him the background of the Earth's interest in Virunga. Like the Project Amy staff, Karen Ross had also stumbled upon the legend of the lost city of Zinj. But she had drawn very different conclusions from the story. During the last 300 years, there had been several attempts to reach the lost city. In 1692, John Marley, an English adventurer, led an expedition of 200 into the Congo. It was never heard from again. In 1744, a Dutch expedition went in. In 1804, another British party, led by a Scottish aristocrat, Sir James Taggart, approached Virunga from the north, getting as far as the Rwanda bend of the Ubangi River. He sent an advance party farther south, but it never returned. In 1872, Stanley passed near the Virunga region, but did not enter it. In 1899, a German expedition went in, losing more than half its party. A privately financed Italian expedition disappeared entirely in 1911. There had been no more recent searches for the lost city of Zinj. "So no one has ever found it," Elliot said. Ross shook her head. "I think several expeditions found the city," she said. "But nobody ever got back out again." Such an outcome was not necessarily mysterious. The early days of African exploration were incredibly hazardous. Even carefully managed expeditions lost half of their party or more. Those who did not succumb to malaria, sleeping sickness, and black water fever faced rivers teeming with crocodiles and hippos, jungles with leopards and suspicious cannibalistic natives. And for all its luxuriant growth, the rainforest provided little edible food. A number of expeditions had starved to death. "I began," Ross said to Elliot, "with the idea that the city existed after all. Assuming it existed, where would I find it?" The lost city of Zinj was associated with diamond mines, and diamonds were found with volcanoes. This led Ross to look along the Great Rift Valley, an enormous geological fault 30 miles wide, which sliced vertically up the eastern third of the continent for a distance of 1,500 miles. The Rift Valley was so huge that its existence was not recognized until the 1890s, when a geologist named Gregory noticed that the cliff walls, 30 miles apart, were composed of the same rocks. In modern terms, the Great Rift was actually an abortive attempt to form an ocean, for the eastern third of the continent had begun splitting off from the rest of the African landmass 200 million years ago. For some reason, it had stopped before the break was complete. On a map, the Great Rift Depression was marked by two features: a series of thin vertical lakes, Malawi, Tanganyika, Kivu, Mobutu, and a series of volcanoes, including the only active volcanoes in Africa at Virunga. Three volcanoes in the Virunga chain were active: Mukengo, Mubuti, and Kanagarawi. They rose 11,000 to 15,000 feet above the Rift Valley to the east and the Congo Basin to the west. Thus, Virunga seemed a good place to look for diamonds. Her next step was to investigate the ground truth. "What's ground truth?" Peter asked. "At Earth's, we deal mostly in remote sensing," she explained. "Satellite photographs, aerial run-bys, radar side scans. We carry millions of remote images, but there's no substitute for ground truth, the experience of a team actually on the site, finding out what's there. I started with a preliminary expedition we sent in looking for gold. They found diamonds as well." She punched buttons on the console, and the screen images changed, glowing with dozens of flashing pinpoints of light. "This shows the placer deposit locations in stream beds near Virunga. You see, the deposits form concentric semicircles leading back to the volcanoes. The obvious conclusion is that diamonds were eroded from the slopes of the Virunga volcanoes and washed down the streams to their present locations." "So you sent in a party to look for the source?" "Yes," she pointed to the screen. "But don't be deceived by what you see here. This satellite image covers 50,000 square kilometers of jungle. Most of it has never been seen by white men. It's hard terrain, with visibility limited to a few meters in any direction. An expedition could search that area for years, passing within 200 meters of the city and failing to see it. So I needed to narrow the search sector. I decided to see if I could find the city." "Find the city from satellite pictures?" "Yes," she said, "and I found it." The rainforests of the world had traditionally frustrated remote sensing technology. The great jungle trees spread an impenetrable canopy of vegetation, concealing whatever lay beneath. In aerial or satellite pictures, the Congo rainforest appeared as a vast, undulating carpet of featureless and monotonous green. Even large features, rivers 50 or 100 feet wide, were hidden beneath this leafy canopy, invisible from the air. So it seemed unlikely she would find any evidence for a lost city in aerial photographs. But Ross had a different idea. She would utilize the very vegetation that obscured her vision of the ground. The study of vegetation was common in temperate regions where the foliage underwent seasonal changes. But the equatorial rainforest was unchanging. Winter or summer, the foliage remained the same. Ross turned her attention to another aspect, the differences in vegetation albedo. Albedo was technically defined as the ratio of electromagnetic energy reflected by a surface to the amount of energy incident upon it. In terms of the visible spectrum, it was a measure of how shiny a surface was. A river had a high albedo, since water reflected most of the sunlight striking it. Vegetation absorbed light, and therefore had a low albedo. Starting in 1977, Ertz developed computer programs which measured albedo precisely, making very fine distinctions. Ross asked herself the question, if there was a lost city, what signature might appear in the vegetation? There was an obvious answer, late secondary jungle. The untouched or virgin rainforest was called primary jungle. Primary jungle was what most people thought of when they thought of rainforests. Huge hardwood trees, mahogany and teak and ebony, and underneath a lower layer of ferns and palms clinging to the ground. Primary jungle was dark and forbidding, but actually easy to move through. However, if the primary jungle was cleared by man and later abandoned, an entirely different secondary growth took over. The dominant plants were softwoods and fast-growing trees, bamboo and thorny, tearing vines, which formed a dense and impenetrable barrier. But Ross was not concerned about any aspect of the jungle except its albedo. Because the secondary plants were different, secondary jungle had a different albedo from primary jungle, and it could be graded by age. Unlike the hardwood trees of primary jungle, which lived hundreds of years, the softwoods of secondary jungle lived only 20 years or so. Thus, as time went on, the secondary jungle was replaced by another form of secondary jungle, and later by still another form. By checking regions where late secondary jungle was generally found, such as the banks of large rivers, where innumerable human settlements had been cleared and abandoned, Ross confirmed that the Earth's computers could indeed measure the necessary small differences in reflectivity. She then instructed the Earth scanners to search for albedo differences of 0.03 or less, with a unit signature size of 100 meters or less, across the 50,000 square kilometers of rainforest on the western slopes of the Virunga volcanoes. This job would occupy a team of 50 human aerial photographic analysts for 31 years. The computer scanned 129,000 satellite and aerial photographs in under 9 hours, and found her city. In May 1979, Ross had a computer image showing a very old secondary jungle pattern laid out in a geometric grid-like form. The pattern was located 2 degrees north of the equator, longitude 30 degrees, on the western slopes of the active volcano Mukenko. The computer estimated the age of the secondary jungle at 500 to 800 years. "So you sent an expedition in?" Elliot said. Ross nodded. 3 weeks ago, led by a South African named Kruger, the expedition confirmed the placer diamond deposits, went on to search for the origin, and found the ruins of the city. "And then what happened?" Elliot asked. He ran the videotape a second time. On screen, he saw black-and-white images of the camp, destroyed, smoldering. Several dead bodies with crushed skulls were visible. As they watched, a shadow moved over the dead bodies, and the camera zoomed back to show the outline of the lumbering shadow. Elliot agreed that it looked like the shadow of a gorilla, but he insisted, "Gorillas couldn't do this. Gorillas are peaceful, vegetarian animals." They watched as the tape ran to the end. and then they reviewed her final computer-reconstituted image, which clearly showed the head of a male gorilla.
That's ground truth, Ross said.
Elliot was not so sure. He re-ran the last 3 seconds of videotape a final time, staring at the gorilla head. The image was fleeting, leaving a ghostly trail, but something was wrong with it. He couldn't quite identify what. Certainly this was atypical gorilla behavior, but there was something else. He pushed the freeze frame button and stared at the frozen image. The face and the fur were both gray, unquestionably gray. Can we increase contrast? He asked Ross. This image is washed out.
I don't know, Ross said, touching the controls. I think this is a pretty good image.
She was unable to darken it.
It's very gray, he said. Gorillas are much darker.
Well, this contrast range is correct for video. Elliot was sure this creature was too light to be a mountain gorilla. Either they were seeing a new race of animal, or a new species of great ape, gray in color, aggressive in behavior, discovered in the eastern Congo. He had come on this expedition to verify Amy's dreams, a fascinating psychological insight. But now, the stakes were suddenly much higher.
Ross said, "You don't think this is a gorilla?"
"There are ways to test it," he said. He stared at the screen, frowning, as the plane flew onward in the night. 2. B8 problems.
"You want me to what?"
Tom Siemens said, cradling the phone in his shoulder and rolling over to look at his bedside clock. It was 3 a.m. "Go to the zoo," Elliot repeated. His voice sounded garbled as if coming from underwater.
"Peter, where are you calling from?"
"We're somewhere over the Atlantic now," Elliot said, "on our way to Africa."
"Is everything all right?"
"Everything is fine," Elliot said, "but I want you to go to the zoo first thing in the morning."
"And do what?"
"Videotape the gorillas. Try to get them in movement. It's very important for the discriminant function that they be moving."
"I'd better write this down," Siemens said. Siemens handled the computer programming for the Project Amy staff, and he was accustomed to unusual requests, but not in the middle of the night. "What discriminant function?"
"While you're at it, run any films we have in the library of gorillas. Any gorillas, wild or in zoos or whatever. The more specimens, the better, so long as they're moving. And for a baseline, you'd better use chimps. Anything we have on chimps. Transfer it to tape and put it through the function."
"What function?"
Siemens yawned.
"The function you're going to write," Elliot said.
"I want a multiple variable discriminant function based on total imagery."
"You mean a pattern recognition function?"
Siemens had written pattern recognition functions for Amy's language use, enabling them to monitor her signing around the clock. Siemens was proud of that program. In its own way, it was highly inventive.
"However you structure it," Elliot said, "I just want a function that'll discriminate gorillas from other primates like chimps. A species differentiating function."
"Are you kidding?" Siemens said. "That's a B8 problem." In the developing field of pattern recognition computer programs, so-called B8 problems were the most difficult. Whole teams of researchers had devoted years to trying to teach computers the difference between B and 8, precisely because the difference was so obvious. But what was obvious to the human eye was not obvious to the computer scanner. The scanner had to be told, and the specific instructions turned out to be far more difficult than anyone anticipated, particularly for handwritten characters. Now Elliot wanted a program that would distinguish between similar visual images of gorillas and chimps. Siemens could not help asking,
"Why?
It's pretty obvious. A gorilla is a gorilla, and a chimp is a chimp."
"Just do it," Elliot said. "Can I use size?"
On the basis of size alone, gorillas and chimps could be accurately distinguished. But visual functions could not determine size unless the distance from the recording instrument to the subject image was known, as well as the focal length of the recording lens.
"No, you can't use size," Elliot said.
Element morphology only.
Seaman sighed.
Thanks a lot. What resolution? I need 95% confidence limits on species assignment to be based on less than 3 seconds of black and white scan imagery.
Siemens frowned.
Obviously, Elliot had 3 seconds of videotape imagery of some animal, and he was not sure whether it was a gorilla or not. Elliot had seen enough gorillas over the years to know the difference. Gorillas and chimps were utterly different animals in size, appearance, movement, and behavior. They were as different as intelligent oceanic mammals, say, porpoises and whales. In making such discriminations, the human eye was far superior to any computer program that could be devised.
Yet Elliot apparently did not trust his eye. What was he thinking of?
I'll try, Seaman said. But it's going to take a while. You don't write that kind of program overnight.
I need it overnight, Tom, Elliot said.
I'll call you back in 24 hours.
3. Inside the coffin. In one corner of the 747 living module was a sound-baffled fiberglass booth with a hinged hood and a small CRT screen. It was called the coffin because of the claustrophobic feeling that came from working inside it. As the airplane crossed the mid-Atlantic, Ross stepped inside the coffin. She had a last look at Elliot and Amy, both asleep, both snoring loudly, and Jensen and Levine playing submarine chase on the computer console. As she lowered the hood. Ross was tired, but she did not expect to get much sleep for the next 2 weeks, which was as long as she thought the expedition would last. Within 14 days, 336 hours, Ross's team would either have beaten the Euro-Japanese consortium, or she would have failed, and the Zaire Virunga mineral exploration rights would be lost forever. The race was already underway, and Karen Ross did not intend to lose it. She punched Houston coordinates, including her own sender designation, and waited while the scrambler interlocked. From now on, there would be a signal delay of 5 seconds at both ends, because both she and Houston would be sending encoded burst transmissions to elude passive listeners. The screen glowed. Travis. She typed back. Ross. She picked up the telephone receiver. It's a bitch, Travis said. Although it was not Travis's voice, but a computer-generated flat audio signal without expression.
Tell me,
Ross said.
The slants are rolling,
Travis's surrogate voice said. She knew his slang. Travis called all competition slants. In most instances during the past 4 years, the competition had been Japanese. Travis was fond of saying, in the 80s, it's the Japs. In the 90s, it'll be the Chinks. Either way, it's slants, and they all work Sundays and to hell with the football game. We've got to keep up.
Details, Ross said, and waited for the 5-second delay.
She could imagine Travis in the CCR in Houston hearing her own computer-generated voice. That flat voice required a change in speech patterns. What was ordinarily conveyed by phrasing and emphasis had to be made explicit.
They know you're on your way, Travis's voice whined. They are pushing their own schedule. The Germans are behind it. Your friend Richter. I'm arranging a feeding in a matter of minutes. That's the good news.
And the bad news?
The Congo has gone to hell in the last 10 hours, Travis said. We have a nasty GPU.
Print, she said. On the screen, she saw printed, Geopolitical Update. Followed by a dense paragraph. It read, Zaire Embassy, Washington states eastern borders via Rwanda closed. No explanation. Presumption Idi Amin troops fleeing Tanzanian invasion Uganda into eastern Zaire. Consequent disruption. But facts differ. Local tribes, Kigani, on rampage, reported atrocities and cannibalism, etc. Forest-dwelling pygmies unreliable, killing all visitors Congo rainforest. Zaire government dispatched General Muguru, a.k.a. Butcher of Stanleyville, put down Kigani rebellion at all costs. Situation highly unstable. Only legal entry into Zaire now west through Kinshasa.
You are on your own. Acquisition White Hunter, Monroe, now paramount importance, whatever cost. Keep him from consortium. We'll pay anything. Your situation, extreme danger. Must have Monroe to survive. She stared at the screen. It was the worst possible news. She said, "Have you got a time course?" Euro-Japanese consortium now comprises Hakamichi, Japan, Gerlich, Germany, Vorster, Amsterdam. Unfortunately, have resolved differences, now in complete accord. Monitoring us, cannot anticipate secure transmissions any time henceforth. Anticipate electronic countermeasures and warfare tactics in pursuit of 2B goal. They will enter Congo, reliable source, within 48 hours, now seeking Monroe. When will they reach Tangier? She asked. In 6 hours. You? 7 hours. And Monroe? We don't know about Monroe, Travis said. Can you booby him? Absolutely, Ross said. I'll arrange the booby now. If Monroe doesn't see things our way, I promise you it'll be 72 hours before he is allowed out of the country. What have you got? Travis asked. Czech submachine guns found on the premises with his prints on them carefully applied. That should do it. That should do it, Travis agreed. What about your passengers? He was referring to Elliot and Amy. They're fine, Ross said. They know nothing. Keep it that way, Travis said, and hung up. 4. Feeding time. It's feeding time, Travis called cheerfully. Who's at the trough? We've got 5 tap dancers on beta data line, Rogers said. Rogers was the electronic surveillance expert, the bug catcher. Anybody we know? Know them all, Rogers said, slightly annoyed. Beta line is our main cross-trunk line in-house, so whoever wants to tap into our system will naturally plug in there. You get more bits and pieces that way. Of course, we aren't using beta anymore except for routine uncoded garbage, taxes and payroll, that stuff. We have to arrange a feed, Travis said. A feed meant putting false data out over a tapped line to be picked up. It was a delicate operation. You have the slants on the line? Sure, what do you want to feed them? Coordinates for the lost city, Travis said. Rogers nodded, mopping his brow. He was a portly man who sweated profusely. How good do you want it? Damn good, Travis said. You won't fool the slants with static. You don't want to give them the actual cords. God, no, but I want them reasonably close, say within 200 kilometers. Can do, Rogers said. Coded, Travis said. Of course. You have a code they can break in 12 to 15 hours? Rogers nodded. We've got a dilly. Looks like hell, but then when you work it, it pops out. Got an internal weakness in concealed lettering frequency. At the other end, looks like we made a mistake, but it's very breakable. It can't be too easy, Travis warned. Oh, no, they'll earn their yen. They'll never suspect a feed. We ran it past the army, and they came back all smiles, teaching us a lesson. Never knew it was a setup. Okay, Travis said. Put the data out and let's feed them. I want something that'll give them a sense of confidence for the next 48 hours or more, until they figure out that we've screwed them. Delighted, Rogers said, and he moved off to beta terminal. Travis sighed. The feeding would soon begin, and he hoped it would protect his team in the field long enough for them to get to the diamonds first. 5. Dangerous signatures. A soft murmur of voices woke him. How unequivocal is that signature? Pretty damn unequivocal. Here's the piss-up 9 days ago, and it's not even epicentered. That's cloud cover? No, that's not cloud cover. It's too black. That's the ejecta from the signature. Hell. Elliot opened his eyes to see dawn breaking as a thin red line against blue-black through the windows of the passenger compartment. His watch read 5:11, 5 in the morning, San Francisco time. He had slept only 2 hours since calling Siemens. He yawned and glanced down at Amy, curled up in her nest of blankets on the floor. Amy snored loudly.
The other bunks were unoccupied. He heard soft voices again and looked toward the computer console. Jensen and Levine were staring at a screen and talking quietly. Dangerous signature. We got a computer projection on that? Coming. It'll take a while. I asked for a 5-year run back as well as the other piss-ups. Elliot climbed out of his cot and looked at the screen. What are piss-ups? He said. PSOPs are prior significant orbital passes by the satellite, Jensen explained. They're called piss-ups because we usually ask for them when we're already pissing up wind. We've been looking at this volcanic signature here, Jensen said, pointing to the screen. It's not too promising. What volcanic signature? Elliot asked. They showed him the billowing plumes of smoke, dark green in artificial computer-generated colors, which belched from the mouth of Mukenko, one of the active volcanoes of the Virunga range. Mukenko erupts on the average of once every 3 years, Levine said. The last eruption was March 1977, but it looks like it's gearing up for another full eruption in the next week or so. We're waiting now for the probability assessment. Does Ross know about this? They shrugged. She knows, but she doesn't seem worried. She got an urgent GPU, geopolitical update, from Houston about 2 hours ago, and she went directly into the cargo bay. Haven't seen her since. Elliot went into the dimly lit cargo bay of the jet. The cargo bay was not insulated, and it was chilly. The trucks had a thin frost on metal and glass, and his breath hissed from his mouth. He found Karen Ross working at a table under low pools of light. Her back was turned to him, but when he approached, she dropped what she was doing and turned to face him. I thought you were asleep, she said. I got restless. What's going on? Just checking supplies. This is our advanced technology unit, she said, lifting up a small backpack. We've developed a miniaturized package for field parties. 20 pounds of equipment contains everything a man needs for 2 weeks. Food, water, clothing, everything. Even water? Elliot asked. Water was heavy. 7/10 of human body weight was water. And most of the weight of food was water. That was why dehydrated food was so light. But water was far more critical to human life than food. Men could survive for weeks without food, but they would die in a matter of hours without water, and water was heavy. Ross smiled. The average man consumes 4 to 6 liters a day, which is 8 to 13 pounds of weight. On a 2-week expedition to a desert region, we'd have to provide 200 pounds of water for each man. But we have a NASA water recycling unit which purifies all excretions, including urine. It weighs 6 ounces. That's how we do it. Seeing his expression, she said, It's not bad at all. Our purified water is cleaner than what you get from the tap. I'll take your word for it. Elliot picked up a pair of strange-looking sunglasses. They were very dark and thick, and there was a peculiar lens mounted over the forehead bridge. Holographic night goggles, Ross said, employing thin-film diffraction optics. She then pointed out vibration-free camera lenses with optical systems that compensated for movement, strobe infrared lights, and miniature survey lasers no larger than a pencil eraser. There was also a series of small tripods with rapid-geared motors mounted on the top and brackets to hold something, but she did not explain these devices beyond saying they were defensive units. Elliot drifted toward the far table, where he found 6 submachine guns set out under the lights. He picked one up. It was heavy and gleaming with grease. Clips of ammunition lay stacked nearby. Elliot did not notice the lettering on the stock. The machine guns were Russian AK-47s, manufactured under license in Czechoslovakia. He glanced at Ross. Just precautions, Ross said. We carry them on every expedition. It doesn't mean anything. Elliot shook his head. Tell me about your GPU from Houston, he said. I'm not worried about it, she said. I am, Elliot said. As Ross explained it, the GPU was just a technical report. The Zaire government had closed its eastern borders during the previous 24 hours. No tourist or commercial traffic could enter the country from Rwanda or Uganda. Everyone now had...
reason for closing the eastern border, although sources in Washington speculated that Idi Amin's troops fleeing across the Zaire border from the Tanzanian invasion of Uganda might be causing local difficulties. In Central Africa, local difficulties usually meant cannibalism and other atrocities. "Do you believe that?" Elliot asked. "Cannibalism and atrocities?" "No," Ross said. "It's all a lie. It's the Dutch and the Germans and the Japanese. Probably your friend Hakamichi. The Euro-Japanese Electronics Consortium knows that Ertz is close to discovering important diamond reserves in Virunga. They want to slow us down as much as they can. They've got the fix in somewhere, probably in Kinshasa, and closed the eastern border. It's nothing more than that." "If there's no danger, why the machine guns?" "Just precautions," she said again. "We'll never use machine guns on this trip, believe me. Now, why don't you get some sleep? We'll be landing in Tangier soon." "Tangier?" "Captain Monroe is there."
6. Monroe. The name of Captain Charles Monroe was not to be found on the list of the expedition leaders employed by any of the usual field parties. There were several reasons for this. Foremost among them, his distinctly unsavory reputation. Monroe had been raised in the wild northern frontier province of Kenya, the illegitimate son of a Scottish farmer and his handsome Indian housekeeper. Monroe's father had the bad luck to be killed by Mau Mau guerrillas in 1956. Footnote: although more than 19,000 people were killed in the Mau Mau uprisings, only 37 whites were killed during 7 years of terrorism. Each dead white was properly regarded more as a victim of circumstance than of emerging black politics. Text continues. Soon afterward, Monroe's mother died of tuberculosis, and Monroe made his way to Nairobi, where in the late 1950s he worked as a white hunter, leading parties of tourists into the bush. It was during this time that Monroe awarded himself the title of captain, although he had never served in the military. Apparently, Captain Monroe found humoring tourists uncongenial. By 1960, he was reported running guns from Uganda into the newly independent Congo. After Moise Tshombe went into exile in 1963, Monroe's activities became politically embarrassing and ultimately forced him to disappear from East Africa. In late 1963, he appeared again in 1964 as one of General Mobutu's white mercenaries in the Congo, under the leadership of Colonel Mad Mike Hoare. Hoare assessed Monroe as a hard, lethal customer who knew the jungle and was highly effective when we could get him away from the ladies. Following the capture of Stanleyville in Operation Dragon Rouge, Monroe's name was associated with the mercenary atrocities at a village called Avakabi. Monroe again disappeared for several years. In 1968, he re-emerged in Tangier, where he lived splendidly and was something of a local character. The source of Monroe's obviously substantial income was unclear, but he was said to have supplied communist Sudanese rebels with East German light arms in 1971, to have assisted the royalist Ethiopians in their rebellion in 1974-1975, and to have assisted the French paratroopers who dropped into Zaire's Shabab province in 1978. End of Side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.